This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 13th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with Purcell. Hello and welcome to the 157th edition of Culture, with me, Robert Bound, in association with Purcell. Today we'll meet former KLF artist and cultural troublemaker Jimmy Courty.
I think you want to just be moving forward all the time and trying to come up with the next thing and not really being scared to just like let ideas go, throw them away. There'll always be more ideas coming.
We'll find a different way of judging the great cultural capitals of the world.
If these places are just built as tourist destinations, I think it's going to be a challenge. If these places don't integrate into the local community and kind of offer them something there, it's going to be difficult.
And we'll investigate Australia as a land of forgotten languages and meet those trying to save them. Plus a Midori House session from the most wonderful singer, Foy Vance. Hit writer Dan Wilson tells us how to write a number one song, and we take a spin on a cultural roundabout in Graz, literally. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. This week's musical entertainment comes from Foy Vance, a folk singer from Northern Ireland via Oklahoma. As a child, he and his preacher father relocated to the southern state, and it's from this experience that Foy draws many of his influences. His musical style could be compared to that of folk pop's Mumford and Sons, with whom he shares a record label, Glass Note Records, but with a little more rasp, a little more soul perhaps, and a finely waxed moustache to boot. His most recent record, Joy of Nothing, tells 10 tales of love's pain and features collaborations with UK chart favourite Ed Sheeran, who he recently supported on tour. Foy Vance swung by the studio to play us a few tracks, and here he is first with You and I.
Well, tomorrow may not be like any other day, no. It's so hard to know now what with the collective they. See, lately they've been swinging high the wrecking ball, tipping down on the foundations I spent so long. Making sure it would be strong. But you and I, we are hard as stone. Ooh. You and I, we are hard as stone. And I'm here empty out my pockets in the hot one day. Then I'll turn my back and I'll simply walk away. And they may think it over and reach out their hands, but I've long since disappeared by then like water in the sand. See, gold was all that they had planned. You and I, we are hard as stone. Ooh, you and I, we are hard as stone. They're like pawns on a tie. Now I'm back here castling, trying to find my feet, find my joie de vivre again. But I can make it on my own. I may need something strong that I can build new hope upon. Everybody needs a little hope sometimes. But you and I, we are hard as stone. and I, you and I.
That was Foy Vance with You and I. Hear from the man himself later on in the show in regular style. Now, if you fancy a coffee in a museum foyer or a canapé under the gaze of a collector's spread of portraits, where should you go? The Palais de Tokyo in Paris, the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, a Guggenheim? Take your pick. We're being a little glib, but seriously, it's an interesting discussion. Where does culture, with the most aplomb presentation, ties it up in a duck egg blue box with a nice bow? Well, the leading cultural destinations of the world is a resource done semi-subjectively that's a bit like Monocle's own soft power survey, only all on culture. The man behind it is Florian Würpfefeld, and here he is to talk us through the hallowed halls where art and the flat white fanciers mix.
My background is I come from the hospitality world. So I worked for Soho House for many years, and looking at a museum, I always felt like you can actually splice up a museum a little bit like a hotel, you know, like a hotel has, you know, a restaurant, a spa, gym, and so on and so forth. And museums have a little bit the same, you know, they have the exhibition programming, the architectural and spatial design, the eat and drink, the restaurant offering, the hospitality offering, the shops, the digital experience. I mean, every hotel has a customer publication. But that museums, I mean, the top ones do have, but I think, you know, museums should become more content destinations also. I mean, the Tate, for example, does it in a great way, and the Metropolitan does it in a great way. But I think overall, they have so much content, and there's more to offer for the consumer, not only to just to go to a museum, but to actually, the exhibition starts much earlier when you're at your house preparing for your journey or for your visit. And so that's what we did. We basically kind of looked at museums in these different categories. We interviewed different people, as I said before, and all the data goes into an algorithm we developed with scientists from Oxford University. And basically it calculates a ranking. And so we are not saying this is the best museum, we're just publishing it.
Maybe. So you can blame it on the computer.
We blame it on the computer.
If people don't like the results. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that you put up there about the, we talked before we turned the microphones on about whether we're entering or exiting through the gift shop, maybe both. Mm. When I went to the reopening of the Rijksmuseum last year, the director sort of said, well, you know, this is it's a place for people to meet as much as anything else. Mm. Obviously, we want people to go and scurry through all these different doorways and have a great voyage of discovery. But essentially, you know, if the coffee's no good in the cafe and if the atrium's not nice enough, then it's not going to be a success, which is an amazing thing. Presumably, that's the sort of thing that you've been finding.
Yeah, I mean, I really believe that museums are not just places for education and, you know, to see great exhibitions, but they've become social hubs, you know. In Paris, you go for lunch with your friends to the Palais de Tokyo. In New York, the Brooklyn Museum has a Michelin star restaurant called Saul, which is incredible. I think I've been to an amazing breakfast brunch place for Sundays. It's at the Centre Pompidou on the roof called Restaurant Georges. I think this is really something which museums have to offer today. And it's also a good way to kind of reach new audiences, because some people go there because of the exhibitions, but some people go there just to have a coffee and then they leave through the exhibition. So there's different ways into it.
How far does the sort of huge tie-up, the current contemporary tie-up with art and money have to do with this? Do you think sometimes there are some big investors in a certain well-known museum brand, maybe it's the Tate or something, and if they don't have a decent cafe, then the investors aren't going to turn up? Do you think it's a calling card for the sort of higher echelons of the art world as much as for the tourists?
Well, I mean, you know, I think one thing is for sure. I mean, the educational side of things costs money for the museums, and the lifestyle bit, the shop and the restaurant, is actually bringing the money. And I think since the credit crunch 2008, things have really changed for a lot of museums. A lot of museum directors think much more entrepreneurial today. They have to, in order to sustain the business. And I think it's actually a good thing that, you know, they're actually becoming more self-sustainable economically. I think, you know, the self-sustainability economically with the restaurant and the shop offering is also kind of integrating much better in the local community. So it's also a social sustainability. I think that's actually a positive development from my point of view. And I think this is what we're going to see in the future a lot.
And this idea of sustainability is an interesting one. I mean, there are so many museums being built. I mean, the Guggenheim effect is something that you can also, it's obviously got a capital G, it's almost got a capital E because it is such a sort of well-known proper noun these days. What is the downside of that? I mean, I expect some of the places that you've looked at, been to, that might be in your survey are kind of allied to the Guggenheim effect, but not all of them work. You can end up with some cities with an amazing museum and nothing around it.
For sure. I mean, there's, I think, about 30 big cultural developments going around the world, from, you know, Abu Dhabi, Doha, West Kowloon District in Hong Kong, Helsinki, there's a Guggenheim coming. What's really crucial here is if these places are just built as tourist destinations, I think it's going to be a challenge. If these places don't integrate into the local community and educate the local community and kind of offer them something there, it's going to be difficult. Same thing with if these museums only show blockbuster exhibitions. I mean, I love Jeff Koons to see it in New York, but if I fly to see Jeff Koons in Abu Dhabi, I mean, I would like to also see a local experience. And I think you have, again, it's a little bit similar to the hospitality industry. If you go to Paris, you want to have a French experience. If you go to Miami, you want an American experience, or like, you know, and if you go to Italy, you want an Italian experience. And same thing with art. So I think if these places are just being built to kind of pull tourists with kind of a global proposition, it's going to be difficult. And I mean, of this, at the same time, you know, looking, I don't want to now mention any specific regions, but, you know, sometimes they are just like vanity projects from prime ministers who want to leave an architectural legacy. I mean, it's overall positive that a lot of culture is being offered, and it's responding to a trend, because I think the consumers really see culture as a new part of their life. It's not just like something you do on the side. It's part of their lifestyle. I know a lot of like young people go to museums and libraries to study and, you know, meet friends. But, you know, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they're going to sustain the business, because if governments have to put in money for the next 50 years, they might dry out with money, and they will say to these museums and destinations, guys, you've got to make your own money.
We're going to end where we might have begun, but I think it's always nice to save the best to last, or the result to the end of the show, right? Yeah. So tell us briefly, Florian, what your categories are and just a couple of the winners.
So for our awards, we have 9 categories. We have 6 categories which come directly from our website. The 6 categories are Leading Culture Destination 2014, which is the overall winner, which is this year the Tate Modern. And, you know, we're all big fans of Tate Modern. I mean, they do a great job. And then Digital Experience, Eat and Drink, so which is the hospitality side of things, Architecture and Spatial Design, and Exhibition and Programming. Then we have 3 jury awards, which are voted by our jury based on a shortlist, and that's City for Culture, Best New City, Best New Cultural Destination, and Best Art Experience in a Hotel.
Oh, wow. Okay. So just like come to my party in room 73 and we'll see if we can make something.
Yeah,
pretty.
No, but you know, like, for example, people who go to Berlin, you said that you're going to Berlin.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you go to Soho House Berlin, for example, it has an amazing collection from, you know, Olaf Eliasson to
and
Thomas
they have a proper
Demand.
Curator in charge of all that.
Exactly. So, I mean, yeah. There's a lot of hotels are really kind of integrating into the local artistic community, and I think that's great. And there's amazing hotels where you can really have an incredible experience.
That was Florian Wupperfeld, co-founder of the Leading Culture Destination Awards. And for a full list of winners, head to leadingculturedestinations.com. When Britain arrived to claim Australia as a colony, there were 250 or so indigenous languages. Only a handful now survive, but as in Wales and Ireland, there's a growing desire to reclaim these lost tongues. In the city of Adelaide, the local Kaurna people thought they had little hope. Their language was pretty much wiped out by 1860, but then in the 1960s, a tiny notebook turned up, a treasury of Kaurna words recorded by 2 German missionaries in the early days of the colony. Now, local linguist Dr. Rob Amery and a band of enthusiastic local Kaurna people are working to turn those rediscovered words from another era into a living language. Rob Amery told Annie Haswell that Kaurna wasn't a lost language, but one deliberately destroyed by an early colonial government bent on assimilation.
That was deliberate policy to separate the kids from the influence of the elders and from their parents. And it's amazing just how quickly language shift took place. And many people have told me that in that assimilation period, the elders, the parents, withheld the language from the kids. because if the children were heard speaking an Aboriginal language, that was reason to take the children away.
Kaurna was an oral language, so if it hadn't been for the linguistic curiosity of two young German missionaries, it would have been lost forever. Instead, Klamar Schulman and Christian Teichelmann's carefully transcribed notebook of Kaurna words turned up more than a century later on the other side of the world.
It wasn't until 2011, on the occasion of the 175th anniversary of the formation of the Dresden Mission Society, that Kaurna people had a chance of actually seeing these documents and handling these documents for the first time over there in Germany. And yes, that was a very, very emotional experience for those people. It gave them a tangible connection with their ancestors, with their linguistic heritage.
So what kind of words and phrases and sentences were found in those old notebooks, and how do they relate to modern life now?
The missionaries, of course, were most interested in communicating the word of God, and they were very interested in speech and thought. And so we have many verbs documented to do with speaking and thinking in various ways. They did a good job in documenting body parts too, even to the extent of bilobilina, the ensiform cartilage. Who knows where that is? It's the cartilaginous bit on the end of the sternum. When it came to fish, they did a dreadful job and obviously didn't go fishing, even though fishing was a very, very important part of Kaurna economy. So it's a bit patchy, the record. No one bothered to document a word for echidna. And of course, there's plenty of echidnas running around the Adelaide Plains. There would have been a Kaurna word for it.
So how do you go about reviving a language when you have a limited amount of knowledge of it? As you're just saying, only certain things were described. How do you go about building it up again?
Well, let's take that word echidna by way of example. Let's suppose there wasn't a word documented in a neighbouring language. Well, what would we do? Well, there's a few options. We can look up the Latin, and I think it's a tachyglossus, a rapid tongue. So we could easily go for a virila talanya, a rapid tongue. I think, if I'm not wrong, the Greek word echidna comes from thorny or something like that. So we could go for a bitpabutu, a full of thorns thing. And if we look at traditional Kaurna words, we find these kind of words. A scorpion is a kandawati. So not only a sting in the tail, but a lightning tail. And a bee, gadlabati, is the fire grub. So there are those kind of words in Kaurna already. So why not go for a descriptive, which is the way a lot of words come into being in the first place.
The best way to learn a language is learn the fun stuff first and then just slowly build on it.
Yeah. Jack Buckskin is a young Kaurna Noongar man who's on a mission to revive the Kaurna language. He teaches it to young and old, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal students all around Adelaide. He says rebuilding the language is like slowly refilling what was an empty bucket of knowledge about his culture.
The bucket's probably three quarters full. We were pretty lucky with what was recorded and we could sort of pick out a lot of the patterns, but we always have this discussion about if we only had a time machine, what would we do if we were the observers at the time? What would be the most important things that I guess were recorded or weren't recorded that we wanted to be recorded? And a lot of it was a lot of those stuff that you can't see, the beliefs, you know, the cultural side of things, not just the physical stuff that we can see and we can touch and etc. So yeah, getting the whole, yeah, the bigger picture of why we think the way we think.
Okay, so you say the bucket's three quarters full. How long until you can just chat about anything in Kaurna?
Look, I guess a lot of them have fit into today's society. Some of the old words, some words we've had to recreate whole words for because of what do you call a computer and that kind of stuff. You know, it's we could borrow from English like a lot of others do, but I guess we're in the luxuries of being able to create a word because we don't have too many language speakers. So once you learn a word, I guess it just becomes official and you just know it as that. So, you know, creating those words helps us talk about everyday conversational stuff. So after work I'll go home and I'll see my daughter and my son.
And what about dinner?
So maybe we'll eat spaghetti. I love spaghetti.
This would have been an ideal place where they would have been looking for like campfires. So there would have been a lot of campfires along the River Torrens and there would have been a lot of campfires out there.
Kaurna Naranga man Frank Wanganine is taking one of his regular tours around Adelaide, showing people the city through Kaurna eyes, as it was before white settlement. He says watching how quickly the language is now re-establishing gives him hope for the future.
Well, seeing the younger generation coming up and using it, and, you know, some of them young people are, you know, putting it in song and rap, so they're sort of developing that in their own sort of style, which is good. And seeing the young little school kids, you know, singing the language, the Kaurna language, yeah, just makes you feel so proud, yeah. Like businesses, even businesses now starting to use the Kaurna language, and government departments and an whole range of different community people. So they're embracing the language, which is really good.
Yes, getting you ready, that little thinking word in between.
Thanks, Annie, and after the break, I'll meet Jimmy Courty at his studio down Southwark Way.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we're hopping on the Jubilee line now to meet the man who is one half of the situationist art pop geniuses, the KLF, Jimmy Courty. Jimmy's now mostly a visual artist, making wonderfully hellish dioramas of protest and police in various states of moral bankruptcy and spiritual disarray. And his latest show finds him redesigning the police's trusty object of protection, or is it intimidation, the riot shield. Jimmy's made a series of acid house smiley face riot shields for a show at London's Paul Stolper Gallery, and he gave me a tour of his Aladdin's Cave of a studio in Southwark to witness the well from whence these wonderful ideas spring.
They were made for the Occupy eviction from St. Paul's, probably about 3 years ago, I think that was. These people were being evicted. They asked if I had any shields. They knew I had some shields because I was working on riot shields anyway. So I had this other stuff painted on them, this police stuff that was kind of more aggressive. So I needed to think of something that I could paint over them that was kind of non-aggressive. And I had some yellow paint. I didn't really think about it. I just did the smiley face just to cover up something else and gave them to them, and off they went and they were evicted, and that was that. But it was only a couple of years later that I was looking for something to sell down here that I noticed one of them poking out from behind something, and I thought, oh, looks a little bit like art. We thought, okay, this is me and the people who work here. We thought, let's try selling one as a piece of art.
They have an irresistibly collectible quality to them, especially when they're all sort of stacked up like that.
Yeah, you're a certain type of bloke who used to go to raves or something, then they're quite appealing. It's like a must-have item.
Despite what logo or what pattern is put on the front of these things, it's a potent symbol, presumably, that the rioters have the riot shields. What might we discern from that, that people that are there to protect us might be a little bit more aggressive than passive?
I think we can say that there's a good chance that in a situation that you might get in, having a shield to protect yourself might be wise. I mean, the interesting thing about these shields is they're actually ex-police ones. They've been used. And the guy that I buy them off, this secret man up north that I get them off, he gets them from the police after they've finished with them. So that adds a certain kudos to the object, in that it's been used by the police already. So we're just appropriating it, giving it another use, which I like that. I think that's an interesting part of the project.
Can we take a wander around and look at some of these?
Yeah.
There's jam jars, and then there's bigger things which look like they're sort of upturned glass cauldrons.
These are giant jam jars. They're 2 gallon ones. And I do this thing called a riot in a jam jar, which are upturned jam jars with riots happening in them at 1 to 87 scale. I've been doing that for a few years now. And these are larger versions. And the ones that you can see here are clips from another work that I did called The Aftermath Dissecation Principle, which is a very big piece, which is a dystopian cityscape equivalent to 1 square mile, which is 40 feet by 25 feet wide. These jars here have got little extracts from that in them.
And these look like little excerpts, maybe from, I mean, there were the London riots 2-3 years ago, famously. I wonder if they're fictional or whether you've made some up. I see one here, which is a kind of, this is a very knacker caravan in a bog, which is the UKIP head office.
Nigel Farage is actually being electrocuted inside by Bulgarian electricians. Just trying to find the lead and I'll plug it in. There's no sound effects on that, but really you should be able to hear him screaming from inside the caravan. They only do one set of UK police, which is...
These guys down here, right?
No, it's these guys. Those are the only ones you can buy. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them. And we wanted 5,000 police. So what we did is we bought thousands of these, cut all their heads off, and stuck their heads onto track workers' bodies. And then I had to pay somebody to paint all of these. It took this woman called Sophie. It took her 6 months to paint all 5,000 of them.
Sophie's a patient woman. But some of our track workers, it looked like they're, wherever they might be manhandling a crowbar or lifting some girders next to the track.
I use those ones in the riots in a jam jar.
So these guys look like they're kicking someone's head in or doing something similar.
A series I did where they were kicking in the heads of Take That for impersonating them at the Brit Awards. So, there has been violence in the jam jars in the past, but I'm trying to cut that out now.
With your work, ever since the music that's not available online that you made with the KLF, with all the things you've done have all been about making something amazing and then smashing it to bits slightly, right?
Yeah, I would destroy everything if I was allowed to, but... You know, there's other people involved, and I probably wouldn't ever release anything either. Those KLF records, I would have just scrapped them before releasing them, probably.
Well, we'd all be poorer for that, but
It's just, I don't know what it is. I just think sometimes if you're striving for something, it really sometimes helps to just destroy it, whatever it is, and start from scratch again. A lot of the things, the trail of stuff that I've left behind me, I sometimes look at it and think, you know, it's not quite right, or, you know, I'd always want to change it. Can't just let it lie, you know.
Is it about the idea? Is the joy, though, having the idea and maybe collaborating on it with people to a certain extent, but having that idea and staying up all night feverishly doing something only to wake up the next morning and be wanting doing something else? Is there a bit of that in you?
Yeah, I think you want to just be moving forward all the time and trying to come up with the next thing and not really being scared to just like let ideas go, throw them away. There'll always be more ideas coming. And you know, sometimes if you try and stop an idea and take ownership of it, then that can cause problems. You spend a lot of time trying to make something and it doesn't work out. It's good to just keep on forging ahead if you can.
That was artist Jimmy Courty, and check out the Paul Stolper Gallery for his latest show. And he'll also be talking on a panel at London's Hospital Club at the end of the month about the art of protest with the V&A's Gavin Gryden and Little Old Me. Why not Google that too? Other search engines are available, of course. Coming up in the second part of the show, more from our Midori House session with Foy Vance. Dan Wilson, formerly of 90s band Semisonic and songwriter for hire, tells us about the art of penning a hit. And we take a ride on a roundabout with a bit of swing in Austria. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Foy Vance is in the studio this week, playing us music and then talking us through it, as we like to do on this show. We'll hear from Foy in just a few minutes, but first, here he is with Into the Fire.
Wanna be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And walk right into the fire.
melt my heart. Ooh. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And see the fourth man in the fire. And if he is everything. Melt my eyes.
Foy, thank you for a wonderful Midori House session in fine voice, even though I think you're holding it together, you said, before you switched the microphones on.
Yeah.
I want to go straight for the voice. How on earth did you know you could sing like that? Where did it come from? What was the first thing you remember singing and someone going, you should try doing that for a living? It's not, that's something you're blessed with, isn't it? You don't just kind of like, you know, you can't practice to get like that. Right?
Well, no, you know what? No one really ever said you should try and do that for a living. But it was like just singing around the house. It was a big deal in my house. You know, and I would have to, I'd sing a lot, actually. So all I knew was that I really enjoyed it.
So it was up to you to tell someone that you were good at singing. It was the other way around.
Well, you know what, my dad...
Do you know what I'm really
my
good
dad
at?
Definitely picked it out. He was going like, you know, you can actually sing, you know, you should do something.
Yeah.
But doing it professionally was never really the...
This has probably been asked this question a million times, but it's part of the biography that you moved from Bangor in Northern Ireland to the southern states of the US, where
exactly,
your father was
yeah.
a preacher. We won't do the joke by putting man on the end of that. But tell us what that was like, because presumably that's where, I mean, there must have been a lot of blues and roots music and stuff on the radio, or is there still?
I mean, my goodness, in America, there's everything on the radio,
yeah.
you know, it's... wealth of stuff, but that wasn't really so much of my growing up there. I was a kid. I was a baby at the time, really. I think that the sort of American influence was definitely in the church that my dad was a preacher at. They didn't allow musical instruments, so everybody just used their voice, and you would find that people would, you know, find interesting parts. I always loved that. That was my first, earliest memory of music. America was like this kind of mecca, almost, you know, and for more reasons than music and growing up. But then, obviously, as I started to grow up and get more into music, I realise quite how influential American music has been on the world.
Yeah, well, it sounds, to my ear, it sounds obviously like it was hugely influential in that part of the world you were in, even when you were too young to remember it, and are honest about not remembering it. But I read an interview with you somewhere, and you said, you know, do you know what? Sometimes you can't write an album every year because albums need to be about things. So you listened to some seminal records and kind of wondered what the craft was behind them.
The best records to me, like seminal albums, you know, whether it be Aretha Franklin live at the Fillmore, or John Coltrane, Love Supreme.
Mm.
Those records, none of those guys went in to make a seminal record. You know, they were just so focused on what was happening at the time. And I think that's what makes a good record, is being exactly what you are, being exactly what that is. The second you start to think, oh, you know, I want to make it this, it has to be received as this, or this is what... You just can't do that. You can't think too much, you know, you can't.
You're right, you can't go into the studio and kind of go, right, I'm going to nail this, I'm going to take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, I'm going to take three parts of Sgt. Pepper's, I'm going to mix it all in a
exactly.
bag, and something magical is going to come out of it.
Yeah.
And Joy of Nothing, well, came out last year, but what was the wherewithal for that? What went into that in terms of personal stuff? Because lyrically, it's quite a heartbreaker, that record.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to ask you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
But that was the thing, presumably, that you needed something to write a record about, and you found something to write a record about.
Well, when I moved from London, I lived in London for 7 years. But, you know, as wonderful as London is, it just wasn't good for me, creatively speaking. I was just feeling stifled. I was feeling surrounded by the humdrum of industry as opposed to, you know, creativity. And so I moved up to the Highlands. And when I got up there, and that just that sense of stillness, the sense of, you can get a sense of nothingness in a place like that, just being around things that are older than man. So, yeah, no, I had, the album started with that, Joy of Nothing, you know, this peaceful kind of, and the closed hand full of friends, like this, you know, breaking free out of London, a man let loose type thing. So the album really started out full of hope. Yeah, but then the year changed, shall we say. and we got Hope and Heartache in equal measure, really.
All right, nice. Well, that's all right. You see that? Maybe
that's the
secret to writing a seminal record, Hope and Heartache in equal measure.
I plan my next breakup next year.
That was Foy Vance, and his record Joy of Nothing is out now. Find out more at foyvance.com. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I am Robert Bound. It's not often on the Culture Show that we cast our eye back to the golden era of late 1990s inoffensive Midwestern pop rock, an era that spurned such classics as Secret Smile by Semisonic and Closing Time, also by Semisonic. More fool us, though, as the man who penned those Grammy-winning tracks, Dan Wilson, is actually one of the premier and in-demand songwriters in the world. Did you know he co-wrote Adele's Someone Like You and hits for the likes of Taylor Swift, Nas, John Legend, and Pink? No, you didn't. And that's Dan's gift, writing songs that match the pedigree of huge artists who you thought were doing it all by themselves. Dan is in the UK and Europe at the moment, playing a string of tour dates in support of recent album Love Without Fear. And he stopped by Midori House to talk to Monocle's Tom Hall about the songwriter's craft.
Nobody knows it, but you've got a secret smile, and you use it only for me. Nobody knows it, but you've got a secret smile, and you use it only for me.
For me, working with someone in hip-hop, or a rock band, or a pop singer, it's a lot more similar than you'd think, because we've all gone through these very similar experiences. And really, most musicians spent a lot of their teenage years practicing some musical craft. Hip-hop people used to always talk about how they spent their teenage years selling dope. But first of all, I don't quite believe it, because I know they were practicing like their flow, you know? So I think we've all got a lot more in common than you might guess.
Know what I mean? Heard you tear a rose from the roots, the rose screams.
Just like a rose, everybody knows that you are so beautiful. But I feel a thorn on my heart, I should have known. We can't repair what we broke, but I held you close, too close.
Do you run into challenges where maybe styles don't gel, or is that what the process is all about?
My process is usually pretty simple. Like, I try to get it down to the very basics, like just a piano or just a guitar or just some simple element and me and the other person. And we are not really dealing with the flags of style or commercial trends. We're dealing with what's happening in your life, what's going on, you know, what is the elephant in the room? Usually if you ask somebody what in your life is worth writing a song about, they'll say, oh, nothing, I just have the usual same problems as I always have, or I have the same problems as anybody else, or whatever. But then when you ask them, well, what's going on in your life, they're going to tell you these amazing things, and you just say, oh, dude, that last thing you told me, that's our song. We're going to write a song about that. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
And they go, really? That'll make a good song? And you say, yeah, that was a really interesting story.
All I need in this world of tears is someone to give me time and love without fear. Give me time.
The new album, Love Without Fear, you were talking just before the mics came on about some of the illustration work that you do, because you're making a video for yourself there, and I checked out some of it online. There's a very funny cartoon just saying, what would Tom Petty do?
Do you
apply that the Tom Petty philosophy a lot in the studio?
I do think about what, sometimes I feel like my greatest strength in writing a song is I could close my eyes and imagine what comes next. Like, let's say we've written the first verse of a song, I can kind of close my eyes and just wait for a second, and the next section of the song will just fall into my mind. And if that doesn't happen, I think to myself, you know, well, what would Tom Petty sing right now? And then in my mind, I can hear Tom Petty's voice, you know, writing a new idea for me.
Do you think What Would Tom Petty Do should be a song in itself?
I think I could probably write a good song called What Would Tom Petty Do? I really like that.
When people come to see you live, you're playing some shows in the UK and Europe at the moment. I was thinking to myself, if I came along to the gig I'm not sure I would be aware that you'd had a hand in writing all these huge songs. And as far as I'm aware, you perform a lot of them, obviously, because you've written a lot of them. Do you get some people at the shows, maybe not the best informed people, coming up and saying, why were you doing all those covers?
You know, I try to explain during the gig, if I'm playing a co-write that I did and someone else recorded, I try to explain a little bit about it, because I do, like when I sing Someone Like You that I did with Adele, or even Don't You Remember, I perform that sometimes. And I sometimes feel like I'm doing karaoke with my own tune, you know. Part of the reason I do that, though, is maybe like 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I was doing a lot of co-writes, but I sometimes would get into the situation where I'd be in a session with somebody and we'd be writing a song and I'd be not into it. Like, I'd think, well, this is kind of a crappy song we're working on. But maybe their fans, my co-writers' fans, like this kind of crap, you know? I guess we'll just write this song. And so we would finish the song, and I'd think, well, that wasn't very good, but at least it's done. And then nobody ever called me back about one of those songs. Like, no one ever emailed a week later and said, I can't get that song out of my head. Because, in honesty, they were thinking the same thing. So I tried to figure out a way that I could, like, judge, okay, how do I know when something's good? And my best test is just picturing singing it to my friends or an audience. If I feel proud and excited about the image of singing it for you, then I know it's really good.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best of you too. Don't forget me, I beg.
That was musician and songwriter Dan Wilson speaking to Tom Hall. After the break, we'll be getting dizzy at the Steirischer Herbst Art Festival in Graz. Stick around.
Food on film. We traveled to Helsinki to meet the merchants serving up the very best in Nordic cuisine at Helsinki's oldest portside market.
Service and quality are at the very heart of the market's reinvention and its continued importance over the past 120 years. Many of the stall holders have held pitches in these pinewood stalls for generations and forged close relationships with their long-held customers.
Market Value, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
This is Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, the annual Steirischer Herbst Art Festival has been running in the southern Austrian city of Graz for nearly 50 years, the oldest event of its kind in Europe for avant-garde art. Emerging from an amalgamation of local art scenes, including those in neighbouring Slovenia and Croatia, one of the festival's many goals has been to break down the boundaries between both different countries and different art forms. Monocle's Alexei Korolev visits the festival's music section, where he takes a ride on a unique musical carousel created by artists from all over Europe.
Do you hear those bells? They're coming from a rather old-fashioned looking carousel here in centuries-old Carmelite Square in Graz.
Musikprotokoll 2014. Let's merry go round.
Willkommen zu Runde 1.
At first sight, there's nothing to suggest that what's really happening here is the creation of a brand new type of listening experience. But let's slow the pace down a bit and talk to broadcast journalist Elke Czajkner, one of the people behind what's officially known as the Let's Merry-Go-Round Art Carousel.
It's a carousel, but not only a carousel to have fun, it's a carousel to listen. We asked 10 composers from all over Europe to compose, especially for the carousel. They got a software, a simulation software, the composers, so that they could imagine how the listener of the pieces will hear the pieces. So it's really 10 premieres. It's really new music for bodies in motion.
The project is part of something called Musikprotokoll, which is the music section of the Steirischer Herbst Festival. It is organized by Austria's state broadcaster ORF, where Czajkner presents several radio shows.
We wanted to have, during the 4 days of our festival, one project that is for really everybody. And it's wonderful, the sun is shining here in Graz. It's free entrance, so you can just come and take a ride or take 11 rides. It's not difficult to get in touch with new music. Yeah, it can be very easy and it can be fun.
Veronika Kaup-Hasler, the director of Steirischer Herbst, has just taken God knows how many rides in a row. Let's see if we can grab a word with her.
I did 9 of the 11, but then I decided better to leave, but it's a great experience. A very interesting artistic task to make music for movement in this sense. You know, the Steirische Herbst is a wonderful hybrid festival, so there is a lot of creation, new processes started, and in this sense I love that, because this is about sharing and about not staying stuck in the opera houses or in concert halls.
The Carousel is the brainchild of an umbrella arts organization called ECAS, or European Cities of Advanced Sound and Related Arts. ORF radio producer Susanne Niedermeyer is what she describes as the organization's link person in Austria.
The ECAS network is, so to say, the European branch of even a bigger network, of the ICAS network. And it's a network of about 30 festivals from mainly Europe, but also from North America, South America. We have one partner in Australia. And the European branch, as we always say, has a project running right now. And speaking about our carousel, the idea was to invite all of our partners within this project. We are 9 festivals within this specific project. The title of the project is Tools for an Unknown Future. And yeah, maybe you can also see our carousel as a kind of tool for an unknown future, because of course it's important, you know, to also generate more audience for this great music that we are representing, and I think it works really well. And this carousel hopefully will also travel a little bit to other ECAS festivals, so there are plans, but we have to figure out everything.
Welcome to ride number 10, Cyclical Entrainment, a composition by the American artist Piers Warnicki.
And to put the project into historical perspective, here's Christian Scheib, the artistic director of Musikprotokoll, the music section at the Steirische Herbst Festival.
Since we are sitting here facing the carousel and sort of an unusual way of presenting music, whatever, I mean, yes, there is actually a very old tradition for that in the festival. Yeah? I mean, one might think back even to the like early 70s when they had lots of festival concerts or festival projects in factory halls outside the city, also places that you would never expect contemporary music in. Sitting like right here and hearing it in the back, you get the idea of the composer, yeah? I mean, this sort of going up and going around and so. But the interesting thing is when you're sitting actually really on the carousel, only then you begin to realize the subtleties of the pieces, because the composers just did not write a stereo piece that sounds like right now, but it's like 4 channels, and not only the bodies are moving, but also the sounds are moving, and sometimes they are moving with the bodies, against the bodies, like stopping and you go on riding. So I mean, there's like a whole lot of sort of differentiation that you really can only hear when you take rides.
Well, now I simply have to go and give it a try myself. So, all right, here we go. So what you do is you get in that metal seat. Okay. And off we go, I suppose. For Monocle in Graz, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thanks, Alexei. And Steirischer Herbst runs until the end of the week. Find out more at steirischerherbst.at. You might have more luck Googling art plus Graz, of course. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next time, we'll be recapping all the fun of Frieze here in London. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, who put up with some strange recording environments for this particular show. Time for one final song this week from Foy Vance. Here he is with Joy of Nothing. Thanks for tuning in.
We came up with the pouring rain. Same old sun in the sky again. Colored doves and fighter planes sharing the sky like it's nothing strange. Foolish silhouette on an evening sky. A morning greeting, a baby's cry.
I